Hi, and welcome to the Animal Training Academy podcast show, the show for animal training and behavior nerds, where I, Ryan Cartledge, interview the world's most proficient animal training and behavior geeks. We're absolutely thrilled and grateful to have you here with us today. So make sure you hit that subscribe button on whatever you're listening to this on so that you don't miss a single episode. Each episode of this show is brought to you on behalf of the ATA membership. And if you like the conversations in this episode, then you're invited to continue them with like-minded behavior nerds within the membership area, which you can find out more about at www.animaltrainingacademy.com. You'll get access to twice monthly live web classes, the back catalog of previous web class replays, plus a huge library of videos and projects to help problem solve your training challenges. Plus, we're a sociable bunch with an exclusive private Facebook group and forum areas. It's like a Netflix social media platform for animal behavior geeks. We will get started on today's episode where we'll be talking to one Emily Harvey. Emily is currently working as a training and behaviour consultant for Guide Dogs UK, covering Scotland and Northern Ireland. She has worked for Guide Dogs for the last 13 years as a trainer and instructor, both in the UK and here where I'm sat in New Zealand. Prior to this, Emily additionally worked as a sea lion trainer. In 2016, Emily took on a role as a positive reinforcement training specialist in Guide Dogs UK and co-developed Guide Dogs' first standardized dog training program based on positive reinforcement. She has a BSc with honours degree in zoology and is currently in her last year of her clinical animal behaviour master's at Edinburgh University. From a young age, Emily has had a passion for all things training and behaviour and is particularly interested in applied behaviour analysis, cooperative care and choice-based training. She spends her spare time training her chickens, parrot, geese, dog and goats. So without further ado, it's my very great pleasure to welcome Emily Harvey to the show today, who's patiently waiting by. Emily, thank you so much for taking the time to come and hang out with us at Animal Training Academy.
No worries. Thanks for having me, Ryan. This is really exciting because I've been listening to your show for years now. So to be on it is feels quite an honour. So thank you.
The honour is mutually felt. I'm inspired by the work that you guys are doing, guys and girls are doing over there in the UK with Guide Dogs, and I'm looking forward to the opportunity to share more about that in today's episode. And spoiler alert, we will be getting your partner Tony Harvey on the show to supplement this episode, so that will be a following episode on from this one. So lots to look forward to. I know there's lots of people in our audience who train guide dogs, who work with guide dogs in various parts of the world. So this is a episode long in the making, and there's no one better to have on it here today than you, Emily, and Tony in the future as well. So before we talk about all of that, though, let's go back to young Emily. Can you take us back to where it got started with you, where you first learned about positive reinforcement animal training? And we love stories, so share some stories with us from your training odyssey so far.
I've got loads. Where do I start? So my journey, I guess, with positive reinforcement training. I've always been around animals growing up. My sister had horses, we had cats, we used to have sheep in our fields and stuff. But really the positive reinforcement side of stuff came from my parents took me over to SeaWorld when I was young. I was about 11 years old. And my dad loved Florida, he loved Disney, all that kind of thing. Anyway, I remember sitting down in the Shamu Stadium was the first thing we did. Went to watch the Shamu show. And I was just completely like amazed by it. Just couldn't believe the training. The marine mammal training, it's impressive to anyone. And I sat there and just thought, that's what I want to do. I want to train marine mammals. And I said to my parents at the time, I was like, that's what I want to do. And my dad was like, okay, let's go do this. Let's go talk to them. So embarrassingly, he dragged me down to the front of the tank and shouted over a trainer and then came in and said, well, my daughter wants to do your job. You know, what do you do? What does she need to do? And at the time, I was just absolutely mortified. But now I really thank him for it because, you know, they said what I needed to do. And from that point on, you know, I just work towards that. I mean, I've got a lot to, I think, thankful with my parents, I think, because I think I was listening to your growth mindset podcast and it really resonated with me, some of the words and the language that people use with you. Because one of my dad's things was, if you can dream it, you can do it. And he always kept saying that to me, if you work hard enough, you can do this. And all the time, because he kept saying, I won't be clever enough. I won't be able to do that. No, you can do this. You can do this. So I literally, from then on, being 11, was working towards being a marine mammal trainer. So that's why I studied hard at school. That's why I ended up doing a zoology degree. So I went and did a zoology degree because I think the trainer who we spoke to that day had a zoology degree. So I was like, yep, that's what I'm going to do. And in my time at university, in my free time, so my summers, I volunteered. So I went over to the US and I did an internship with Dolphin Plus, I think it was called then, and the Dolphin Research Center, and then spent more time volunteering over here at different seal sanctuaries. And I was just very set, and that's what I was going to do. And I was just, it was the training side of things that I was just fascinated with all the time. So then when I finished my zoology degree, I went off and I wrote a letter to every single place in the UK that had marine mammals. They don't have dolphins over here, but they have sea lions. And I wrote, so I wrote to every single one and said, can you give me an opportunity? I'd love to work with you, da, da, da. And I was really lucky that one got back to me, a little one in North Devon, that got back to me and said, do you want to come down and see what we do? So I went down all nervous and kind of like, oh God, I'm going to do this. They made me stand on the stage and project and talk and see what I'd be like. So I've got a lot to thank for, which was my, she'd probably be listening to this, Nikki Morrison. She was my manager that took a chance on little naive Emily and gave me a job. And that's where I kind of got into it. So, you know, that's when I was introduced to Ken Ramirez, who's, you know, still my idol with things. So IMATA, all that kind of stuff. And yeah, the training was just insane. So then I went off to guide dogs. So I kind of flipped reverse, so marine mammals to dogs, really. And the reason I kind of did that was I realized it wasn't just about the marine mammals for me. It was about the training of stuff and how can we help people with this training. And I thought, what those two things that links up? And I got into thinking about how do those two things go together? What can I do? And then guide dogs came to mind. And I thought at the time, I was like, oh, guide dogs don't just volunteers. You know, isn't that just volunteers? But actually looked at it and they did paid jobs. So I was really lucky to get a job as a guide dog mobility instructor. So I went into guide dog mobility instructing, and that's where I met Tony, who you talk to next week. Obviously, I'm the better half. Guide dog mobility instructor, for those that aren't familiar with guide dog language, that is the people who train the dogs, the advanced training it was called at the time, and then we matched them to somebody with a visual impairment and then we trained them together. Now, I was trained when I first got into guide dogs in a more traditional, we might label it, a traditional way, or balanced method, I suppose. Guide dogs has always used positive reinforcement training, don't get me wrong, but it was a balanced way of doing it. And at the time, obviously, to me, that was, I'd come from the sea lion training world, and I was like, oh, this is a bit strange. You know, I never would have done any of this sort of punishment-based training with a sea lion because you just can't. But I was so appreciative of having my job and all that kind of thing. And these were professionals that were training me. So I was like, yeah, this is what we do. This is how you train a guide dog. But in the back of my head, I always thought, oh, I could do something here. But I guess when you don't want to experiment when you're working with a dog that you think, you know, this is going to guide a blind person, so you don't want to go messing around and doing that type of thing, especially when you're new into the role and you're just really appreciating it, because it's really hard to get into guide dogs. And then I met people around guide dogs that were using more positive reinforcement training, and it sort of inspired me a little bit. And then the biggest thing is I went to New Zealand, so over to you, Ryan, and worked for New Zealand guide dogs. And I was a guide dog trainer there, so I didn't do the people side of stuff. I just did the dog side of stuff. And this was the time where I really got to got to grips with things. So I would have six dogs at a time, dogs back to back, because before I'd just have the dogs for a little bit, then I'd train the people. So I could really play around with what I was doing with different dogs. And I was really lucky that this is where my sort of ABA journey began, is where my manager at the time, Denise Ireland, she's put us on to Susan Friedman's LLA course. And then that blew my mind, as it blows everybody's mind. And I was just off, you know, I was training goldfish. I got chickens over there and I was training chickens. I was just so excited. And what can we do at Guide Dogs here? And then I got hold of Michelle Pouliot's. I've got a lot to thank for her. Like, there was an article about guide dog training somewhere. I think it was online, and it was about how they're using clicker training over in the US. And I was like, oh my God, this is amazing. And somehow it leaked out that we got this. I've still got it on my shelf, actually. I can look over and see it. This little manual that was like how to train a guide dog using a clicker. And it was just this really short manual, and it was like my bedtime reading. And I was just like, this is amazing. So I went off and I read that, and I just tried things out, and I really got to grips with what worked, what didn't work, and all that kind of stuff. And then I went back to the UK, and like you said, I was employed as a PRT specialist, so positive reinforcement training specialist. What a cool job title that came up, and I was just like, this is amazing, I'm never going to get this, and this is so exciting. And was fortunate enough to get that job at the time. So, and that's where STEP came from. So STEP is our standardized training, and it's, guide dogs love an acronym, by the way, so I will explain what they mean. So it's standardized training for excellent partnerships, and that's where we developed our very ABA approached guide dog training program. So we've got 37 behaviors that we train to make a guide dog. And how we started that was me and Robert Ellis, who's one of the ATA members. We sat in a room with our manager at the time, and we looked at a guide dog, and we thought, what does a guide dog need to do when it's finished? What are all the behaviors we need to do? And then we broke those behaviors down and thought, things like, okay, so they've got to stop at a curb, but what other things do they need to do to be able to stop at a curb? We want them to be straight as a curb edge. So we need to make sure that they're trained to stop straight. So we need to teach them platforms. We need to teach them food manners, how to behave around food. And so we broke that down, and now we've got these 37 behaviors that we train each dog. And it takes about 7 to 20 weeks. But it wasn't just us. So this is where I say always include everybody. So we were really lucky. There was about 50 of us when we got everybody together, from, because, you know, positive reinforcement wasn't new to guide dogs, but it wasn't like a standard way of doing it. But we got all different practitioners from around the country, and we sat in a room, and it was like the geekiest thing ever. And we worked out how this was going to look on a week by week basis. So what behaviors do you need on week one, week two, what are the prerequisites for that behavior? And we sort of put it all together. And then we had a look, we had Chirag Patel came and had a look with us, and he had a play around with the dogs. So that was a great day. I think I was completely like, the first time Chirag came and I was like, oh, what is this? This is crazy. This is not my job. I'm an imposter. This is just mental. And then, yeah, Chirag came to have a look at it, and we went through it. And then me and Rob actually tested out the training program. So we went through and we tested out our STEP program with a couple of dogs. And train them up. And then we started to roll out STEP across the organization, which has been an interesting journey, let's just say. So we've got training and behavior advisors. So what we did at the time, so it was quite small. So it was me, Rob, and we had a couple of training and behavior advisors, which is a new role at Guide Dogs. And they are based in the teams. And what they do is they take a couple of people through STEP at a time. But it takes a long time, obviously. We're a huge organization. I think we're the largest breeder and trainer of working dogs in the world. So how we did that on a huge scale, we're still doing it. So we've got about 26 teams that are at Guide Dogs, and people that actually handle the dogs. We've got more than like 250 guide dog trainers and guide dog mobility instructors, and then like another 250 staff that work with the dogs and their health and well-being stuff. So it's a massive project, and I'm not going to lie, it wasn't easy. We had really some really big highs, like it's amazing, but then it was really hard. So there's some, you know, difficult times. Change is hard when you're working with people and you're changing attitudes and beliefs. You know, there's been some good, you know, really good high moments, and there's some really like difficult moments going with it. And but I always think, I look back now and think, how did I stay with that? Because I always think, how did I manage to do that? And I don't know whether anyone's used this term before on this podcast, but you know, we talk about trust accounts. I talk about a passion account. Like, I have this like passion account for positive reinforcement training. Like, it's just in me. And I think because my passion account is so full with positive reinforcement, that the knocks didn't, I didn't go bankrupt. So I just kept going and I kept going and I kept going. I think that's what like really drove me through it. And I still am. And I still get, like, I'll go on today. I should think about all the different stuff that I can talk about. But yeah, it's definitely about that passion account. And we're in a, you know, we're still doing it at the moment. But we've come on like leaps and bounds with stuff at Guide Dogs here. It's amazing, like an amazing organization to work for. So, I mean, even in 2018, I think it was, we changed our ethical training standard. So we are not using positive punishment anymore as a training strategy. That is, we use the ethical roadmap. If we think a dog needs positive punishment, we'll remove it from the program. We're not going to have that dog go through as a guide dog if we think it needs that. We have no more half checks anymore. So half check collars, if people are familiar with those, they were sort of taken away. So it's come on like leaps and leaps and bounds. And we now have, it's not just me and Rob, there's now seven of us training and behavior consultants dotted around the country, and from different walks of life, not just guide dog people. We've got doctors, so doctors of like behavior stuff, and one of them's doctor of dog impulsivity. It's been great having her on there. And we've got 21 training and behavior advisors now around the country. So there's loads of us. It's like a big sort of community there working hard. And it's not just STEP as well. It's not just that we're just doing STEP. We're also got things like, we've got PREP. I said we love an acronym. PREP is puppy raising for excellent partnerships, and that's just starting now. So that's our whole program on how we raise our pups with positive reinforcement. We have like a new welfare code of practice based on David Meller's stuff, so how our dogs are kept. So it's huge. It's not just about the training. There's a bigger picture. Sorry, there's quite a lot of stories.
That's all right. Did you get an opportunity to connect with David Meller when you were here in New Zealand?
No, I didn't. Annoyingly, if I could, that would have been amazing. I know. I bet you have, haven't you?
Yeah, he was at a welfare workshop at Wellington Zoo a couple of years ago. He's an awesome little dude. I mean, his ripples are felt all over the world by humans and non-humans. But talk about ripples, and ripples being, you don't know what comment or thing you do is, and how that's going to influence someone's life, and then all of the animals that person works with, and all of the humans they work with, and all of the humans that those humans work with, and all of the animals that those humans who the humans.
Yeah, and that is a ripple. That is a wave. Myself.
Well, I mean, who do you know who that person was that was training Shamu that your dad went and talked to? I mean, think about the ripple from that.
I've never thought about that. The person that was in the coolest wetsuit that I thought was just like, you're amazing. You're in the Shamu wetsuit. But yeah, like that ripple that he's caused, like me to go off and like spend my whole life doing this. Yeah, it's very, never thought about that.
Well, like, imagine if he was standing there and because I've been in a show situation in a zoological setting where a parent comes up and says, hey, my son's or my daughter's got a pet budgie at home and they are interested in training. What's your advice? And I've kind of been like, you know, in work mode and kind of answering the question. But like, imagine if that Shamu trainer, like some voice came up from the sky and said, like, you are going to influence guide dog training across the entire world by what you say right now. Like, you would have been like, what?
Like, yeah, you know, you would have been crazy.
Yeah, what did he tell you?
So he was basically, I think I remember him being very he'd obviously been asked it a lot, let's put it that way. So he was just kind of like, he said about going to university to do potentially a, you know, a psychology or a zoology type degree. But it was all about, he said to me, it's all about practical experience. So get yourself volunteering, get hands on. It doesn't matter if you're chopping up fish, which I did for a long time, like volunteered chopping up fish and cleaning out enclosures, all that kind of thing. But yeah, he was just inspiring, I suppose. I wonder who it was. That was really interesting. Yeah. And that was it. And I bought a little book. There was a book, I think I've got that on the shelf, How to Become a Marine Mammal Trainer. Whoever made that book is so old, but it's like it told you what to do and, like, you know, all the basic stuff. So yeah, it's great.
We should find out who that person is and send them a thank you card in the mail. Imagine that. Imagine receiving a thank you card in the mail from like a comment you made.
I know.
Decades earlier. So true.
I should look up. I wonder how many killer whale trainers they had at the time. I have to look up like what year
it
was.
I bet you could find it.
Put a shout SeaWorld. Out.
Yeah, we could find that information out for sure.
Yeah, and I bet I could probably dig out a photo of me stood in front of the tank.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, I have to see if I can find that. Yeah, so true. I didn't think about that. The ripples. Huge ripples.
Well, I mean, it makes, I've learned a lesson from talking to you thus far in this episode. Like, I can understand, like, being asked that question over and over again, like, because I have been in my career, but, like, you'd never know who you're talking to, right? Like,
yeah. Because I get it a lot in this job, and probably more when you're front facing training guide dogs and you're out and about on the street a lot more, especially in New Zealand. I was out, you know, I'd say pavement pounding, walking around the streets with the dogs and generalizing stuff and training and all that kind of thing. And there'll be a lot of people that come up and say, how do I get into your job? And I would always, because of that moment, I'd always take the time and put the dog's handle down, you know, so it let know it's not working. I'd talk to them and say, you know, this is what you do and you can do it. And, you know, try and, I guess, that growth mindset now. I'm addicted to that now, growth mindset stuff. Nice. But yeah, just trying to encourage anybody that they can do this thing. If people really want to and they're passionate and they want to do something, like, it's possible. You know, you don't have to be I'm definitely was not an A grade student. I still am not an A grade student. I had to work really, really hard, and it was really tough to get there. Even me doing this master's now, it's been tough at times. That I like, what am I doing this for? But yeah, it's possible. If you can dream it, you can do it.
Thank you, Millie's dad.
I know. Yeah. I know. He'll be cheesing over that as well. Absolutely cheesing.
It reminds me of Steve Martin shared a Walt Disney quote about dreaming.
Yes, he did, didn't he? And that's where it came from. If you can dream, you can do it. That's Walt Disney.
Is it?
As well. Yeah. Yeah.
Sounds very Walt, like, Disney.
Very Walt Disney. Yeah, it's very cheesy, but it's embarrassing at the time when you're about 11 or 12, your dad going around saying this stuff. But actually, yeah, it's really means something. Yeah.
Well, on that note, think about the thousands of downloads that this episode's not to put pressure on you. It's going to get around the world, but there might be a young Emily out there, and something you say today might change the course of their life and all of the learners that they influence. But something you mentioned in your storytelling just then was imposter syndrome, and I'm curious if we can get brave and talk about that right now. I know you mentioned it. I mean, how does that make you feel for me to tell you that, you know, something you say today with the work you're doing with guide dogs, there's young Emilys out there who are looking up to you and listening to what you're saying and implementing based on your experience, but still, like, I understand, man. Like, I just presented at some conferences and I got total imposter syndrome. I'm presenting about businesses and I was like, man, I just burnt out so bad. Like, what am I doing here? Like, I get it.
It's so weird, like, you saying that stuff, and I get it, and I know how hard I've worked and how much difference it can make. But even people saying it to you, you still have that little niggly voice. Like, if somebody could find a cure for imposter syndrome, that would be amazing. It's niggly voice in the back of your head saying, no, it wasn't really me. You know, I'm here by chance. This is like, I've just happened to be here by chance. I'm not changing this stuff. It wasn't really me that designed, like, co-designed that program. It was someone else. And I always think that someone's going to knock at my door and say, yeah, Emily, you don't know what you're doing. What are you doing? All the time. And my manager, he's been great David Grice. I remember first telling him, like, I don't think this is going to work. I just can't do this. And he's like, it's just imposter syndrome. I hadn't heard of imposter syndrome before. And he was like, imposter syndrome, it's the thing. You know, I've been doing this for like 30 years now. And it's, you know, he still thinks somebody's going to come and knock at his door and tell him that he's not knowing what he's doing. And I was like, oh my God, everybody feels like this. But yeah, it's hard to take. It's hard to take compliments and stuff, I think, with imposter syndrome. But I think we all feel it. But the more I talk to, you know, all my colleagues and everybody around, and everybody has that all the time. But as we were sort of talking about earlier, we were saying, you know, maybe it's a good thing. It makes you work harder, maybe. Like, it makes you keep learning, like, makes you want to plan and prepare, maybe a bit too much sometimes. I'm like, oh my God, I've got to prepare for this thing. But it sort of drives you through it a little bit.
Yeah, I think so. I think opportunities to build community around the fact that you're not alone if you do feel this, because as Susan Freeman says, I won't go into her metaphor, but there's always a better tennis player, even if you're Susan Freeman or Ryan Cartledge or Emily Harvey.
That's all right. I was thinking about Michelle Pouliot. She, listening to this thing, oh God, she's going to be thinking, yeah, Emily's saying completely the wrong stuff. I wouldn't do it like that. That kind of thing. It's always those people, isn't it, that you think about.
And I'm sure Michelle Pouliot would say that there's also someone looking at her saying, oh, Michelle, don't say that. And there's someone looking at that person. I only know Nikki Morrison from engaging on Facebook and various groups. And so, Nikki, if you're listening to this podcast, hi, thank you for your ripples. Can you share some stories from your time working with marine mammals under Nikki? What is something you learned then that you've carried that you think about regularly, and like a lesson that you implement with guide dogs now in your work now?
Oh, that's a hard one. Loads of stuff. Winging it probably a lot of the time. So Nikki employed me, and she'd lost a sea lion trainer quite soon after that I started, so they were very understaffed. And I literally had, I think it was about a week or 2 weeks, it was the busiest time of the season, and I had to start doing the shows, and it just had to be done. And I'm just thinking, how am I going to do this? So I was like learning all the lines, all that kind of stuff separately, and putting stuff together. So it's a bit like, it was very behavior stuff, because I was learning all the lines, then I was learning all the cues for the sea lions, and then I was trying to put those things together. And I guess it was just lots of hard work, I suppose, doing a lot of stuff out of work and practicing, going over and over and practicing these behaviors. But yeah, that sort of stuff. And then I guess the biggest thing behaviorally wise, though, that we'll probably talk about a little bit later, but cooperative care, because that was what we focused most of our training on with the sea lions, was cooperative care behaviors, how we got those, you know, huge animals to, we had three males to participate in their daily care, you know, washing their eyes and checking their flippers, all that kind of stuff. And then going over to guide dogs, didn't, you know, at the time when I started, we didn't do any cooperative care behaviors at all, and thinking how that can be applied to the dogs that we work with, you know, and the visually impaired people that we work with as well. So that was probably one of the biggest things, because that was very normal for me to do cooperative care.
So I've just had the fun of training an open mouth behavior with Phoebe dog, and with working with one of your colleagues, Rob Ellis, who shared about his training and the cool contraptions and antecedent arrangements he has for working with one of his dogs. But I've always been fascinated by the large variety of ways people train open mouth behaviours. Curious, did you do that with your marine mammals? And
So with the sea lions, we did open mouth. That was one of the main staples, I think, we did, because we'd have to check their mouth quite a lot. And I'm doing stuff on the screen. I know people can't see me, but I'm like lifting my hands, because I remember the cue for it was like, open your mouth. So we did, I think at the time, looking back on it, was like a bottom chin target and a top, you know, on top of the nose target, and then would separate our targets so that they would get wider and wider and wider. Never found that successful with dogs, though. I tried it with my pet dog. Didn't seem to work. I tried loads of different stuff. I'm still working on it, actually, with my pet dog. It seems to be, it's like one of those things you need to crack, isn't it? I looked at your podcast, your sort of video blog, and I was like, right, I've got to start this again. I'm going to have another go. I like the ice cream, like popsicle thing to keep your fingers in the right place. But yeah, love an open mouth. It's a challenge. Yeah.
Yeah, well, I think dog trainers often look at marine mammal trainers and look at those targets and attempt it. And I attempted that with Phoebe. but I think maybe with Phoebe it was like, and Sarah Owens told me this, is Phoebe's target behavior was with such a strong closed mouth component to it. Maybe there's some difference there with marine mammals. Yeah. I don't know.
Definitely. I don't know whether they're used to. Well, they probably do have wider jaws, potentially, catching stuff and ripping it up. So they could open their mouths really wide, and it was really kind of normal to do. And they'd interact with each other like that a lot, with like open mouths a lot, like spinning their heads around.
Yeah,
so right. Maybe it was, yeah. And it didn't seem a challenge training them.
Oh, that. Now I really want to train a marine mammal.
You really want to do that. Yeah. Although you've got to make sure you're like your criteria's on with that when you've got like a massive sea lion right in your face on a stand, and you're like trying to shape. You've got to think, I am not getting into frustration here, because your face is right next to my face and you've got a massive mouth.
Yeah, but it sounds challenging from that perspective, but such a big learning opportunity to get different ways of training the same behavior with different species.
Definitely. I've got to try it with the goats, but they don't open their mouth much at all.
Not
so that
fun.
Could be an interesting challenge. Yeah, I'll go with the dog first.
Anyway, self-indulgent Ryan aside, bring us up to speed before we move on. Where can people go online to find out more information about you, about Guide Dogs UK? Where is the best place for people to head online if they want to explore more?
So probably if you're looking at Guide Dogs UK, you want, so our website, just let me double check, guidedogs.org.uk, that is our website address. And then if you want to find out more about me, I don't have like a private business or anything like that, but me and Tony do have a Facebook page called Click Click Training. And we share our kind of journey with all our animals that we live with on there. We put that together because I was sort of sharing it on my normal Facebook, and I think my friends that weren't animal training geeks were like, oh, this is really boring. So somebody said, why don't you just put up, you know, have a separate page and just share what you do. So yeah, go on to Click Click Training and have a look at that. But yeah, Guide Dogs they've got a great website. And if people are looking for jobs and stuff with Guide Dogs, that's where they will advertise them on their website. And we're always looking for passionate, positive reinforcement trainers as well. So it's a good place to start your career, I can say that.
I think you'll see a lot of Click Click Training videos on Susan's Behaviour Works Facebook page as well. People might.
Yes. Yeah. I do like to share with Susan. Obviously, Susan's massively reinforcing, isn't she? You'll know, Ryan. Like, you send her stuff and she's like, this is amazing. This is the best thing I've ever seen. And you're like, oh, Susan. And then you just keep sending her more. She's probably created, and I just think she's amazing about how quick she gets back to you. I think she must have so many people that email her and send her things and ask for advice. And, you know, and she's
so
just
annoying.
Her reinforcement. I know. I don't know how she does that. Like, it's like she's like magic. It's just, she's an incredible woman.
I don't know when we're going to release this episode exactly just yet at the date of recording, but episode 150 is with Susan Friedman. And I won't give away too much, but we talk about that in a funny way.
Oh, do you? Yeah.
So if you've already listened to it, if you haven't, then you've got that to look forward to. Hey, thanks so much for sharing everything so far, Emily. We love hearing about people's behavioural odysseys, as we like to call them, so we're grateful for you being brave and sharing everything you just did. Moving forward, would really like to talk more about your work with Guide Dogs. As mentioned already, I know this is a topic our audience has wanted us to talk about for a while now. Some listeners asking me directly and in person to do this. years ago. So if you're one of those people, firstly, sorry, it's taken me so long. But at the same time, and more importantly, I'm just thrilled we get to dive more into this today. Emily, as we heard in your story there and in your bio, you've been part of the team developing Guide Dog's first standardized dog training program based on positive reinforcement. And I'm excited we waited to this episode because we get to learn from 5 years of this program now. If we'd reached out to you a few years ago, then we would have been missing all of that time. And like you say, you have taken leaps and bounds during that period. Consequently, Emily, I was wondering if we could talk about this program a bit more now, what you have learned over the last 5 years, and in your personal opinion, what are now in 2021 the five most important components of training your guide dogs?
Huge, massive question. Last 5 years, I've definitely gone more grey and I've definitely got more wrinkles in a good way, you know, a bit more knowledge of where I am. But I guess what I've, before I delve into the five things, which was really hard, by the way, to think of five things because so many, because we've got 37 behaviours, but I can't talk to you about each 37 behaviours. But yeah, the things I've learned, and I touched on this earlier, but change is hard. I was employed not as a change specialist. I was employed as a passionate PRT practitioner. So I wasn't prepared or wasn't expecting how difficult change was going to be across the organization, not just for me, but for the people going through it as well. So I've had to become almost like a change specialist as well in those 5 years of I suddenly got delved in and started having to learn about change management and what people go through and how to do that, and made, you know, mistakes of how I, to start with, of how I dealt with people. And you know, it's not just about giving people the science. And now I feel sick because I just was passionate and went in there like, it's the science, people, these are the ABCs, this is what you do, and blah, blah, blah. That's not enough to change people's belief and culture. You can't just go in there. So yeah, change is hard. And some of the things I learned from that, I think, was majorly, and this is probably through Susan as well, crucial conversations, all that stuff, is building relationships, trusting relationships with people before you even think about changing them. So, you know, having that open dialogue, let them be able to come to you and say, oh, I don't get this. And you need that relationship with them in order them to get into that sort of change mindset. And they can come to you and talk about it. What are they struggling with? How hard it is. So, yeah, that's a huge one. It's definitely building relationships with people before you think about starting to sort of change their behaviours. Inspire people, that's a thing. Get people to do it. So I know I talked about the science, but, you know, just standing there in front of a room of managers, I remember right at the start, and just showing them a PowerPoint of the science and why we should be doing this, that didn't change their mindset or their beliefs. But what did was getting people to have a go and seeing it. So we developed, it's called, and it's probably one of the best things we did actually, called the Foundation Course. And what it is a just this mini course. It was 5 days, it's now 3 days, we still do it. And it's basically a mixture of a bit of theory and a bit of doing training. So that's for everybody. It's not just for the people who handle our dogs, it's for the office staff, it's for managers that come in. And it basically like inspires people. They bring their pet dogs to work with them. They get to train them some simple behaviors, some targeting behaviors, some stationing behaviors. We teach place, so how to go to a bed, so useful things that they can do, the bucket game. And people get to have a go. Like, so there's something scary about practicing on a guide dog. People are like, I don't want to mess up a guide dog, you know, it's really important, it's a working dog and all this kind of stuff. So people bringing in their pet dogs, they're like, oh yeah, this is great, you can just have a go with pet dogs. So we've got some brilliant pictures and videos of you know, senior managers bringing in the little you know, French bulldogs and then running over to a place. It's given them those wow moments. You see in people's faces, they're just like, my dog did that. Because most of them will come to the foundation course every time, and they, at the start of it, they'll say, my dog won't do anything, just so you know, we won't be able to train it anything at all because he's really lazy, all these labels kind of stuff. And then they're just like, this is amazing, we've got like these bulldogs wandering over doing place and running over and all that kind of stuff. And yeah, so give people those wow moments. That was a big thing. That's been a huge thing when we're going through it. And I guess another one, I've learned so much, I won't go on and on, but be patient. It takes time for people to change their behaviors. You know, you're not suddenly going to show people how to do step and they suddenly get it and they're into it and their behaviors have changed. It might take a few cycles of dogs for them to start changing their behaviors and what they're doing. And it's not that that they're not wanting to do it. It just takes time. Change takes time, and just sit back and just let them go through that stuff. Another great one is really, and Rob will be listening, having a good support network. So it was initially just me and Rob and Dave, our manager, just the three of us, Lone Rangers, when we were sort of designing it and, you know, starting to roll this out and things. But having them as the support network around you, it's needed. So if you can create that support network, so you can pick up the phone, you know. Dave was great. We laugh about it now, but you know, sometimes I'd be in a car park somewhere and guide dogs, crying my eyes out, and I'd ring him up and be like, Dave, I can't go back in there. And you know, then he'd make me laugh, and it was just like, oh, this is ridiculous. And he's like, it's fine. And we all supported each other through the difficult times, and we laugh about it now. It's okay to cry, it's fine. And you need to have that relationship with the people around you that you can just be honest. You need someone, I think I've heard Susan talk about it, you need those people that you can go away behind the scenes and have a bit of a rant and a moan to. You can't always be that, have that face on, that positive face on all the time. You need those people that you can trust to talk about it. And like we talked about earlier, imposter syndrome, it's normal. Like, that's what I've learned. I think it's normal to feel like that, especially at the start of this program, rolling out this program. And we all laugh about it now. Like, because Ken Ramirez is my massive idol. He was like the first person that just like blew my mind, all that kind of stuff. Obviously, and Susan. Like, it's too many, isn't there? I don't want to put someone out. But I used to have these stress dreams at the start when we were rolling out the STEP program. And one of them was like, Ken would come into my dreams and be like, it doesn't work. It doesn't work with guide dogs. It works with everything else, but not guide dogs. And then I'd phone my manager in the morning and be like, Ken's come into my dream and says it doesn't work. And it's okay to feel stressed like that and question what you're doing. It makes us learn. And I guess just one more thing on what I've learned, and this is like really important that to make sure you do, is take time to see the good things. It's quite easy when you're in the midst of a change program to only hear about the things that are going wrong, the complaints that you might get, because you're having to deal with that and you're having to deal with those difficult things, and you forget to take time to go and see the clients training their dogs, go see the staff that are loving it. And I think you need that. You need to make sure that you have those times. And I think that's what builds up your passion account. So you need to make sure you're going to see dogs doing things and you're going to see them change people's lives. And because when you get too far away from it, you really need to keep doing it. It's really funny because your cat's tail keeps coming past. It's hilarious. But yeah, that's what tops up the passion account. See the good stuff and make yourself see through the other stuff. Make sure you see all the good stuff that's happening around you and all the change, all those ripples and effects that you're having.
Your answers weren't what I expected, but in a good way. They were perfectly what needed to be said, because there is no other thing that needs to be said other than what you thought. Because every one of those 5 points. So I've got building relationships, inspiring people, being patient, having a good support network, and taking time to see the good are about people.
Oh yeah, sorry, I've still got loads others though. I've still got another five. So they're just the ones, that's just what I've learned. That's what I've learned. I haven't even started on the other five yet.
I wanted to say that, like, we want to dive into your passion account, so you've just...
Yeah, I'm diving. Sorry, I'm diving deep.
Understand that we have. No, good. I'm glad we haven't started.
That's what I've learned. We haven't even started on the components yet,
all right,
Ryan.
I'm going to zip it up and then hand it back over to you.
Okay. So when I'm thinking about, this was hard actually, to drill down to the five most important components of guide dog training. So I'm going to go through them. They're not in any particular order, so it's not like one is better than five or any kind of thing. They're all sort of equal. So the first one I'm going to talk about is self-control. Now, I feel like you should have a buzzer when we say a label like that, because what a huge label is self-control. What does that look like? And I feel like that's when Susan hits her head and goes, what are you saying that for? It's a massive label. But self-control within guide dogs is quite a, it's a big thing that we work on. So, and it is a set of behaviours. It's just an overarching label for a set of behaviours that we have. And we talk a lot about self-control versus impulse control and the differences between the two. How we, I know everybody talks about them differently because they are labels, so it's all subjective. So at guide dogs, how we talk about them. We're lucky to have Dr. Hannah Wright, who's got her PhD in dog impulsivity, and she's taught us loads about self-control, which is just so important. So the way we look at self-control and impulse control, so self-control, we say, is sort of a behavior that's uncued by the handler. So it's more of an environmental or context cue rather than an actual, rather than somebody having to give a cue, like a touch cue or something like that. And that is what we really need. We need behaviors that are controlled by the environment, not by the handler, because our clients cannot see to cue the dog. They cannot see if the dog has noticed another dog to say touch and bring it back. They cannot see if there's a burger on the floor and to tell the dog to leave it. They can't see that. So we need the dogs to be able to sort of control their own behavior. So we call that an overarching self-control type thing. And they're things like, so it goes through all of our behaviors really. So it, like stationing at doors, so making sure that they are not racing through the door, you know, getting in and out of the car, leaving food on the floor. So that the cue for that, if there's food on the floor, it needs to be the dog goes, oh, food on the floor. The cue is, that's the cue to keep on walking. So my cue is I lift my head up and I keep going, and I get reinforced at the next curb, because all of our behaviors are designed, you know, so the client knows when to reinforce the dog, because otherwise we can create, you know, behaviors that aren't desirable. So the dog should, and we do a lot of training with that. So I see the food on the floor, I lift my head up and I drive towards my next objective point. Same with if they see a, you know, a squirrel or a dog or a cat, that should be a cue to, oh yeah, squirrel dog, I keep going, because the client cannot cue those behaviors. So it's continue on your line of travel. So we teach that a lot, and we try and incorporate that in all aspects of the dog's life. You know, when they take a toy, you know, that should be when they, you know, see the handler with a toy, that's their cue to all 4 feet on the floor until they're told okay otherwise. And we don't use weight, we don't use a weight cue with our training. We just, the dogs will stay there until they have a release cue, and we find if we do it enough and in loads of contexts, as you would expect because the science tells us so, it's like a generalizable skill, it's like a transferable skill across contexts, and the dog will start to offer it in different situations. So yes, self-control is a big one, a big thing that we work on, a really important skill for dogs to know. And then the next one, so another one, this is sort of split into two parts. This is creative learners. So this is with dogs and people. So we want to create creative learners. So if we talk about dogs first, we want dogs that offer behaviors. You know, we know that positive reinforcement creates that discretionary effort. We want dogs to work things out, to try really hard and go above and beyond the norm of what they would. You know, if a lot of our clients might hang back, they're not sure where they are or where they're going, we want that dog to give that extra oomph. No, here's the crossing box. It's here. You come with me. You're going the wrong way. If they're sort of veering across a road, which can happen, and the person sort of is not sure where they're going, and they start to veer towards, you know, a busy main road, we want the dog to pull back and go, no, no, you're coming here. So we want that discretionary effort. We really want dogs to work, to try and work things out. And that's what positive reinforcement training does. To start with, when we first introduced PRT to guide dogs, I think people were a bit scared by that oomph that you got in the dogs. You got that oomph to go and do stuff. But actually, that's just, it's created such strong behaviours. And in the sense that with those creative learners, with the dogs, we, generalisation is so important. I think, I would say guide dogs is probably one of the hardest dog jobs, I would say, out there. You know, they have to concentrate for how long, you know, hours at a time of walking and working. It's not just discrete behaviours. So we need to make sure we generalise those behaviours to make them creative. So when they face a scenario that they've never faced before, they offer things. So we try and set up different different scenarios, you know, different types of obstacles. We want different people to handle them. We want to go to all these different type of environments. And that what creates these dogs who are just like, yeah, I can do this. Yeah, I haven't seen this before, this trap obstacle where I'm stuck and there's a hole here, hole there. I'm going to have a go and I'm going to go around this way. And that's what we want to create. And positive reinforcement training does that straight away. It just creates, we know what it does to animals, don't we? It just creates animals that try and keep trying. And it's the same with people as well, those creative learners with people. So when we first started rolling out STEP, and we still have now a bit of a recipe. So each behavior had step one, step two, step three, step four. And it was like, you must stay to these steps. And it made me think of it the other day when I was listening to Eva on here. I think she was talking about creating creative learners or something along those contexts. But what we found was that if we didn't give people all the principles, they would get stuck if their dog didn't do what it said on the list. So now we sort of focus on, we still have those. We still have that guide of like, this is step one, step two, step three, but we also try and give people the principles. So, okay, if your dog doesn't do this on step three and it does this, what could you do? And what could you put into place? And that really has created us, like our staff workforce of being very creative. And now I see people, you know, go and see and like, where did you come up with that? That's a really good idea. And that's what we want, because we want to make sure STEP is ever changing and it's always getting better. And that's how people learn. I won't talk about the client side of creative learning, because I'm just think Tony probably will, and he'll kill me if I talk too much. we've gone to that. So yeah, creative learners, that's number two. Number three will be cooperative care, which we touched on earlier. Really important with our building up that trust account with clients and all the way through. So we have, as part of STEP, we have the bucket game is a standard behavior that we train all the dogs, and the chin rest is probably the most important one because it's tactile. It's a tactile behavior that clients can do. So we would do the chin rest on a person's knee so they can check the dog's ears, check, clean the dog's teeth, all that kind of thing, or the chin rest on their hand. So the dog will put its chin or its muzzle, should I say, onto the client's hand. And they can do that in veterinary scenarios. So they can have a bit more control, the person can, when they go into vets, and the dog can offer a chin rest, and they can actually tell if their dog is saying no because it's broken that chin rest. So they can say to the vet, can you stop a minute while my dog does that? But that has been probably with clients, one of the most popular behaviors is the cooperative care. Clients are amazed that, you know, previously they might have had to, like, their dog would hide when they got out ear cleaning treatment and they couldn't find their dog, and how stressful it must be when you can't see to try and administer treatments and stuff. So yeah, the chin rest has been amazing. And there was a particular client there, so we had a deafblind client that I went to see. It wasn't one I was training, but it was early on in our STEP journey, and I went down to see how they were getting on. And the communication between the two of them, it was just like, it was amazing. This guy thought that he couldn't have this dog because it needed its ears cleaning wiped out once a week, and it also had a long coat to be groomed, and he thought he couldn't do that. And I've got this, and I have to share it with you sometime, Ryan, this amazing footage of him, and he is nonverbal, and him sitting there and his dog and communicating with his dog that's on his knee, and he's cleaning out his ears, and it's just, and the dog is just getting it, and he can, and the dog lifts up his head, kind of says no at one bit, and he stops, they stop, then he engages again, and it's just like, it's magic. Like, if you think of somebody that, you know, can't see and can't hear, to be able to communicate with their dog like that is just, it's just amazing. I remember coming out of that and to the person that was training them and saying, oh, that brought a tear to my eye. And she said, yeah, I know, he's amazing, isn't he? And I said, oh, it wasn't just that. It was that execution of that chin rest. It was amazing. It was really well trained. So I was like, bring a tear to my eye with that stuff. So yeah, cooperative care, huge. And now this is another big label. Wait for it. I feel like I need your buzzer again of like, meh, meh, meh. Resilience, that word resilience, or resilience building, should I say. So it's a big label that's used a lot in the guide dog field, maybe in other assistance dogs organizations as well. And as I spoke about earlier, it's a really hard job that our dogs have to do. You know, they have to work for long amounts of time. it is a hard job. Things happen. You know, a client, they might get distracted and the client might trip off the side curb. They might trip into something. They might walk into something, which can be a big shock for the dog. And, you know, if you were to walk into something in blindfold, you know, it's going to make you jump, and then it can make dogs jump. And one of the biggest myths about positive reinforcement training is that it doesn't prepare the dogs enough for the real world. Like, so we're too nicey-nicey with them all the time. You know, it's all about food. It's all about nice things. And it doesn't create that dog that's resilient enough to be a guide dog. And they think that they will crumble when a mistake happens. When they first go out with a client and the client trips, they think that dog will crumble. Now, I wish there was a science, like a scientific study to do on this. If anybody's listening that wants to do something, so it would be amazing. But anecdotally, what we see is dogs that are trained with positive reinforcement training bounce back quicker. Now, I think that's because of the trust account, because they have had so much positive reinforcement training in their role. You know, they throw their heads in the harness. They want to work. They want to get to that curb. They want to, you know, find that post office. That when something bad happens, they don't go bankrupt. You know, something happens and the person trips, they just kind of go, oh yeah, anyway, on to my next thing. And they're just not bothered about it. And it's just, that's really anecdotal, but we see that so much more. Previously, what we might have seen if there was a, you know, an incident that happened, that dogs wouldn't want to walk past that area again. They would often go, no, don't want to go near there. I'm not turning right down this road because something bad happened here. But we don't see that as much now. So we get that. So we do create that resilience, and how we do that is different. So historically, we might have just got the dogs used to it. So I guess a bit habituation, I suppose, that people might have, you know, slowly started tripping or stumbling. But you have to be really careful about how you implement that, because it can easily cause sensitization. So if you do too much of it too soon, it's really hard to juggle. But now we actually prepare them for it positively. So we start off with, and really systematically, so we start off with things like platform training. And I think probably most of the listeners will know what platform training is, but getting the dogs to really drive towards a platform, that's one of our main behaviors that we train. And they've got a real strong history with platform trainings. I always say, you know, you've trained a platform really well if you put it up on the side of the wall and the dog's trying to climb on it. That's what we want to see. But so what we do is we use a platform, and then we will slowly introduce things like we'll slightly trip. And then we'll go to the platform, and then dogs are, oh yeah, and they might trip a little bit more. Or we might hang back on the handle and pull it one way, so it has to pull you back, and then it gets something good. So we'll do it sort of really systematically, and how we do that. And what you see is these label resilient dogs that kind of bounce back. They're like, yeah, come on, then we're going this way, and I'm going to pull you this way, and I'm going to do this, and yeah, you've tripped, but I'm going to carry on. So that's huge. So resilient stuff is a big one, I think, resilience building with our dogs. And then my final one is slightly different, I suppose, but it's well-being, the bigger picture. So it's not all just about training. It's having that, and we call it guide dogs, that dog-centered approach to everything we do. So it's not just about what we do when the dog's in harness, which is amazing and awesome, but it's how they're housed, you know, how are dogs housed. So they used to come into kennels, you know, which were very practical. You know, they had to be cleaned and scrubbed, so they were quite barren. Now we use fosterers, so we use fosterer homes, so we have people that look after the dogs, and we've turned our sort of kennel environment into a fun doggy daycare. It's all about enrichment, so our dogs don't get fed from a bowl often, so when they're in training. We use all different enrichment toys, all that kind of stuff, scents, all different things. And our dog health and well-being staff, they do all the cooperative care with the dog. So when the dog's getting groomed, we use the bucket game. It's a big thing. It's for that moment that dog is born, how we bring that up in a well-being sense. You know, having choice as well, it's huge around bedding. What do they like? Some dogs like curling up in a big comfy bed. Some just like lying on the floor. Some like a plastic bed. It's giving them the choice, and we find out what they like. Do they want to be with other dogs in the daytime? Some of them don't. don't. So we have an option where they can they all have their own space if they want it, or they can be mixed with other dogs. All those things. And like we talked about earlier, that's our five domains model. So we're looking at, you know, we've just started implementing to make sure we've got a welfare code of practice where we base it on Mella's five domains of stuff. So it's huge. We want to make sure the dogs, every point in their life, from being a pup to wherever they go, to when they get transported, when they're introduced to cars, to when they're introduced to the harness, when they're in the kennels, we want them to have that sort of dog-centered approach where they have choice and control over their environment. I think that makes a huge difference to their well-being and how they see work. I almost don't like the term work anymore, because I don't think dogs see it as work. If you see the dogs now throwing their heads into the harness, wagging their tail like woohoo, here we go, this is like fun time, it's not like they're working, it's hard work, because they enjoy it and they see it as fun. So yeah, that's my five.
Well, unfortunately, we can't use any of that because it's just too many labels. So,
I thought you were going to say that it didn't record. But, oh, no. I know, all the labels. Susan will have me off. There's so many labels. Hopefully, I explained my labels.
No, I'm just having you on. Number one was self-control. Number two, creative learners. Creating creative learners. Number three, cooperative care and the importance of that. Number four, resilience building. And number five, focusing on the wellness. Looking at the time, we're going to have to leave it there. I have questions about all of those points, but we will head towards the end of this episode and allow our listeners to explore further online if they want to learn more. You've also offered us the name of the episode in your passion talking then, and that is Ken Would Come Into My Dreams.
Oh no, is that going to be the name of it? That's going to be hilarious.
I'm just joking. Possibly. Sorry, not sorry.
I should never tell that story.
No, in all seriousness, thank you so much for all of that, Emily. Like I said, sadly, we are going to head towards the end, but we do like to end our episodes asking our guests to take us into the future now and share with us from a guide dog's perspective or from a larger ripple-making perspective, what do you want to see happen over the next 5 to 10 years in the animal training world?
Well, I guess so. Well, in the assistance dogs world and guide dogs world, I think if we can get away from the use of labels, it's very much a labeling thing. We label dogs, you know, willing and, you know, they're a good working dog and all these different labels. What I'd like to see more is if we focus more on behaviors that the dogs did rather than labeling them in a certain way. So definitely that. I'd love to see more sharing across organizations between, you know, guide dogs or assistance dogs organizations. It is happening. It is starting to happen, I think, because of COVID and the, you know, the way we're doing Zoom calls and all that kind of things. There is more sharing happening, but it would be great to share practices and share best practice learning with our other organizations, and making sure that we never stay static. I think that's a huge thing. I really hope that STEP doesn't look the same even in 12 months time. I hope that it has changed quite significantly as we learn more. So let's just never stay still and keep learning and help each other, I think is the key.
Beautiful. I want to, even though we don't have time, because I just want to seize the opportunity in front of me. When talking earlier, you talked about the importance of building relationships. And so I'm just curious to get your thoughts on, final thoughts for us positive reinforcement trainers. And notice I used the word unintentionally, but I did. Us, them.
And
which excludes them, non-positive, which is the opposite of what I actually want this question to be about. But you talk about what you want to see is more sharing across organizations. And I think sometimes if people are using different tools or different techniques, like I've just unintentionally thrown out there, there can be an us versus them mindset. And if we were to think about training an animal who might be doing what we might label as undesirable behavior, one possible starting point would be one that you identified earlier in building relationships. How do we in 2021 move towards this? How do we break down barriers and open up communication and conversation? And I'm asking you because I feel like it's part of something that you've been successfully involved in.
Yeah. I mean, it's been up and down, I'd say, but I've learned. I really think it's, again, I mean, it's about creating that trusting, positive relationship with people. And I think we really need to think about not having that us and them situation. It did start at Guide Dogs to start with when we started rolling out Step. There were Step people and non-Step people. That isn't anymore because everybody's doing it. We don't have that. But it's listening to other people and listening to their background, hearing what they have to say, being non-judgmental. And, you know, if you've got that relationship with someone and they come up to you and say, oh, you know, Emily, I corrected that dog. But that's amazing that you reinforce them for doing that. Like, you come to me and you've spoke to me about that. So it's having that open dialogue and really listening to what they're saying. And I don't know, we really need to break the bubble down that us and them positive reinforcement thing, and including people in what you're creating. Like, it shouldn't be just your people that are really keen on positive reinforcement training. Include those people in what you're trying to create. And if they are on board and they feel like they've had, you know, a few points into how that behavior is going to be created or what the behavior looks like, you will get so much more buy-in with other people. So yeah, it's huge. I could talk about that all day, but yeah.
Well, hey, I think you've identified within yourself what we all feel, either consistently or at times, and that's a small dose or a big dose of imposter syndrome. But to jump into an episode and say, listen in a non-judgmental way, I think we should all shut up and listen to Emily Harvey.
That's crazy to say that.
Thank you so much for sharing everything.
Thanks.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for sharing everything today with us, Emily. Just before we do officially wrap up for the third time, I know we've mentioned this already, but where can people go online to learn more about all of the things you've shared today?
So if they want to go to Guide Dogs website, so that's guidedogs.org.uk, which is where you can learn about, it's got some videos on there, positive reinforcement training, and where any jobs come up. And then if you want to see what I do when I'm playing around with the goats and the chickens and all that kind of thing, and I'm very honest, and we often put on things that don't go so well on it and all the mistakes we make, you can go to mine and Tony's Facebook page, which is Click Click Training.
Wonderful. And we will, of course, link to all of this in the show notes as well. Hey, Emily, this has been so much fun. From myself and on behalf of everyone listening, we really appreciate you taking the time to come on the show today. Thank you so much.
Amazing. Thank you. It's been an honor.
We do, of course, really appreciate all of you tuning in today as well. And if you have enjoyed this episode and you were interested in carrying on the conversation about working with our animals in the most positive, funnest, choice-rich ways, then as mentioned at the start of this episode, the Animal Training Academy community is waiting for you. Head on over to www.animaltrainingacademy.com and click on the membership button in the main menu to learn more about what members are describing as the Netflix social media platform for behavior geeks. That's it for this episode though. We're going to wrap it up there. Thanks again so much everyone for listening. You'll hear from us again soon.